inaugurated a personal canvassing campaign, visiting literally every single retail establishment in the district over a period of about 6 weeks. I devoted my mornings to this activity and used as a little memento by which people could remember that I'd been there, pencils, which turned out to be very popular for a number of campaigns, printed with my name and candidacy. And in that way, I met information centers by the hundreds, to wit, the retailers, many of whom were willing to display my picture card in their windows after my visit, and also to meet their customers, with each one of whom I carefully shook hands. And this is a very special technique, because it is very essential in connection with it not to get bogged down, not that one does not wish to debate the issues, but that it is essential to cover the ground, and that takes time and does not allow for diversions. That's a big warning to any candidate. Don't get bogged down in a debate when you're out shaking hands with prospective voters. But simply accept the fact that a certain percentage will not agree with you and go on to work for your strength, which is a great political principle of mine, instead of taking an inordinate amount of time trying to make up for your weakness. Paragraph, the main issues in the campaign of 1946 turned out to be housing for veterans and the end of price controls, which President Truman had then installed on meats, the avoidance of war, which meant a positive position toward the United Nations with an adequate admixture of ideas as to how it operate in order to be the great agency for peace, which it was designed to be at San Francisco in 1945, and what to do about the danger of communist takeovers in which was then very imminent in Greece and Turkey, where under the cover of partisan internal warfare or civil war, backed by the communists on the left, an effort was being made to subvert the sovereignty and democracy of these countries. The positions to be taken were clear and were confirmed by subsequent events, but the alertness and initiative with which they were handled was the critical point as far as the voters were concerned. Also, my experience as a lawyer and my experience in the armed forces served me very well in respect of the particular interest of the refugee Jewish families in the district in respect of the restitution claims on the German Federal Republic, and on East Germany as well, resulting from the confiscations and barbarism of the Nazis before and during World War II. Paragraph. Accordingly, on Election Day, with the confluence of all the factors which I have described, though I did not win by a majority of the votes cast in the district, I did win by a plurality, and the miracle was performed. My next really hard in the next 2 years to solidify what I had won in the 46th election. And it proved to be a very rewarding, but an extremely difficult and exacting task. Paragraph, I have now given a sample of how I would intend to deal with campaigns, and this treatment would be applied to all the campaigns in which I have been engaged, occurring as they do through the book, not exactly in chronological order, but nonetheless substantially in chronological order. Otherwise, the respective issues would not fit into the narrative. End of note. Paragraph. The next heading would be chronology of great issues and the personalities relevant thereto. It's really amazing going over the past record to see how many things were started which came on through the years. In my very first session in the Congress from January to July to the end of July of 1947, I have issued annual reports to my constituents every one of the 29 years that I've been in the Congress. And it is fascinating to me that in the first one, issued on July 24th, 1947, I quoted the words which are on the inscription, which are the inscription on the National Archives building in Washington. Quote, "What is past is prologue," end of quote. The prologues of 47 were destined to be the problems, the achievements, and the frustrations of all the 3 decades thereafter. We enacted the first bill to assist Greece and Turkey. And we began to participate in the in foreign aid through a foreign relief bill, and in the International Refugee Organization, dealing primarily with the displaced persons of Europe, then still in the displaced persons camps. Indeed, I spent the summer of 1947 with two colleagues, Representatives Fulton and Shelf, Fulton of Pennsylvania and Shelf of Kentucky, investigating the displaced persons camps. And in that investigation, we visited, out of the 750 such camps, 250, a monumental undertaking, and had and made therefore a vital contribution to the ultimate enactment of the Displaced Persons Act, in which the United States joined in cleaning out the displaced persons camps of Europe by taking its fair share, and also by pursuing a strong policy respecting the resettlement in Palestine of the surviving Jews of Europe who found themselves in the displaced persons camp, and were the decisive factor in Israel's becoming a state in 1948. 1947 saw the beginnings of the Marshall Plan, concept having already been authored by General Marshall, then Secretary of State, in a famous speech at blank. We began to lay the groundwork for a new version of inter-American cooperation through a common determination to resist threats or acts of aggression against any American republic, and through a greater intensification of cooperation in inter-American military defense. The struggle over Palestine as a homeland for the Jewish people broke open, and the resolution of the United Nations partitioning Palestine and forming the essential basis for the Jewish state of Israel came soon thereafter on November 30, 1947. Great hopes as a for the utilization of the United Nations as a peacekeeping agency still remained before us. Paragraph. Moving to the home front, 1947 saw the enactment of the Taft-Hartley Law over President Truman's veto. I voted with Truman to sustain his veto because I thought that the law was inadequate on the subject of strikes threatening national paralysis, like a strike which was then threatened in the coal mines. Subsequent history of the Taft-Hartley Act has certainly borne out that concern. My other concern that the Taft-Hartley Act was punitive as far as labor is concerned has also been borne out in the intolerable delays which have affected adversely both labor and management in respect to the activities of the National Labor Relations Board. Delays further compounded by the subsequent Landrum-Griffin Act. Paragraph. Prominent in these considerations was also the agonizing fear that the 1932 Depression should not be repeated. And hence I joined with many other veterans in a plea in an effort to determine how we could stabilize our private economy, quote, so that individual freedom is preserved and economic security is afforded to our people. This particular piece needs to be added about the campaign of 1946, which I have outlined in some of the foregoing records. One of the people whom Alex Rose wanted me to see on the long list that I described was a lady named Bella Dodd, who was the secretary or principal factor in the teachers' union in New York City at that time. And quite unbeknownst to me, Bella Dodd, during the years that I was away in service, surfaced as an alleged communist fellow traveler, or perhaps even communist. In any case, I did go to see Ms. Dodd simply in the way that I saw many others, as an introduction and to ask for support. The very same thing I had done with 40 other people on these lists prepared for me by the Republican and Liberal Party leaders. But this Bella Dodd situation came back to haunt me many years later when in 1956, in the course of a primary campaign for Pat McCarran's seat in the Senate in Nevada, one of the candidates who was a former employee of the Judiciary Committee Internal Security staff made the charge that I had gained my first election to the Congress through communist influence, to wit, Bella Dodd. Bella Dodd, in that 10-year interval, had turned to the right position as an alleged communist. And apparently, I was also part of that story, and tied into my FBI file, which I knew nothing whatever about, but this individual, who had been employed by the Judiciary Committee, did know about. Indeed, one of the anomalies is that I subsequently went on the Judiciary Committee, and this man continued to be employed by the committee. Indeed, I didn't ask that he be fired particularly. It was the water over the dam long since by then. But that confluence of events brought on an enormous crisis for me in the 1956, in the summer of 1956, which was still the holdover of the McCarthy period, and really was directly responsible for my running for the Senate. I was then Attorney General of New York, and had I not run into this particular situation, might very well have gone the state route, as I had had a remarkable success in 1954 in being elected Attorney General of New York over Franklin D. Roosevelt, Jr., and might well have opted to run for governor in 1958. Which it turned out was the year that Nelson Rockefeller ran for governor. And had things worked out differently, we might never have had Nelson Rockefeller in U.S. politics. But I shall go into that story in much greater detail in respect of the campaign of 56. During my first days in the House of Representatives, the most interesting personalities I met were Joe Martin, the majority leader and now speaker of the House of Representatives, an old-fashioned, long-standing Republican Paul from Massachusetts, in the rapidly becoming depressed Fall River area. And James W. Wadsworth, who had been senator from New York for blank terms and was now serving in the House of Representatives. A very unusual switch, but one quite characteristic of the man. Others whom I encountered who attracted and appealed to me as individuals or as legislators were Jim Fulton of Pennsylvania, one of the most attractive and charming men I have ever met, with whom I became close friends, and with whom I shared many laughs in the rollicking sessions of the House of Representatives in those post-war years. John Voorhees of Ohio, of whom more later. Helen Gahagan Douglas, and the unforgettable Mrs. Blank, herself a nurse who had succeeded her husband in the House of Representatives, and was also a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Nor is it easy to forget Saul Bloom of New York, who for so long had been the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and had lost that post in the landslide victory which put in a Republican House in the 1946 election. Clarence Brown must also be mentioned in this connection, as well as the majority leader, Clarence Brown of Ohio. Incidentally, that blank name for formerly a nurse is Mrs. Bolton, B-O-L-T-O-N. Joe Martin was a very genial soul, and befriended me early. early at the behest of a staunch Wilkie supporter named Sam Pryor, who later came to take a major position with Pan Am, the airline. Joe was a very practical politician, but very considerate of the new members in terms of their complete freedom of action. And in that respect, he suited me fine, because his motto was, as long as you vote Republican for the organization of the House, from then on, it's your job to get reelected and to do whatever it takes to get reelected. A very interesting and a very pragmatic political philosopher. And at a later time in my career, when Joe Martin was no longer Speaker of the House, but still a member, and I was first elected to the Senate, some 10 years thereafter, and was about to take my seat, Joe Martin came into the chamber, put his arm around me, let his gaze sweep around the chamber. It was the day we were being, the day I was being sworn in. And said, "Jack, this is a very hard place to get to. Ask me, I've tried for years." End of quote. By the way, the majority leader's name was Charlie Halleck. Charlie Halleck, on the other hand, the majority leader, was a very interesting, hard-fisted, Middle Western politician from Indiana, who, giving nobody anything, not those on his side and not those on the other side, a thorough conservative devoted to politics as a calling, really, and as majority leader conceiving his role to be to carry out a party policy to which he contributed, but which was, he felt, collectively arrived at by an admixture of a president, if we had one, the Republican National Committee, and the congressional leadership, and then doing his utmost in every way possibly open to him to get that policy implemented by actual laws passed in the Congress. He counted only one thing, your vote. And if he didn't have that, in varying degrees, he could and did express his displeasure. Charlie was crusty, but interesting. John Voorhees was also something like Charlie Halleck, a Republican conservative, but a man of intellect, and it had broken through to him that there was no way that you could have peace in the world unless the United States was willing to take chances in terms of making agreements which would keep the peace, undertake responsibilities, and especially tried to deal with the crushing disaster which World War II had been to the peoples of Europe. We had many struggles in respect of foreign aid and other matters, like the Greek-Turkish program, but John Voorhees would always come around. Even though he would start out very difficult, generally in opposition. But invariably, his good judgment and decent outlook would bring him around to some reasonable compromise, which could be worked out between him and others like myself who had different views. And among these, I include John Lodge of Massachusetts, who later went on to be ambassador and governor of Connecticut, and Christian Herter of Massachusetts. later went on to be Secretary of State of the United States. Another very interesting personality was Walter Judd, the most tried and true of the China hands, very favorable to Chiang Kai-shek, who had spent a good part of his life as a missionary in China and believed that that Mao Zedong and his associates represented a grave threat to the whole world. Those were the days of the beginning of the China lobby and the beginning of a series of resolutions pledging the United States against favoring the admission of mainland China to the United Nations. A very far cry indeed from what Nixon, also a conservative Republican, did later on to change radically that policy in 1972 and 1973. Now, that shouldn't be 73, 72 and 3. It should be 70 and 71. Frances Bolton was a very interesting woman, a woman of great wealth, formerly a nurse who had married her employer, who was a member of Congress, and then succeeded him in the seat. I owe to her my subsequent advocacy of major U.S. aid to nursing education. And indeed, my interest in health legislation generally, being in my very first session of the 80th Congress when I first came there, the proponent of a bill to establish a National Institute for Research in Heart Disease, which subsequently became law in 1949. Clarence Brown of Ohio was a big man, a rugged senior Republican politician who sort of took me under his wing, hoping to make a convert of me, but finding himself unsuccessful, would have a habit of sitting next to me just before some important vote and putting his arm around me and suggesting that I might think very seriously about voting the way he would rather than the way I was going to and the way he knew I was going to, no matter what he said. But it was a very friendly feeling, and I really appreciated it as a freshman representative. Paragraph. In connection with Jim Fulton, I have spoken of the camaraderie of the House. And indeed, it was a very a interesting place in that way. The individual characters were very colorful. One knew almost in advance what they were going to say, and yet one listened with real expectancy because of the fact that it contributed to the general texture of the country, which once so unfolded before one in the House of Representatives, and to the real earthiness of the proceedings. And there was no one with whom I shared more of the mirth that given situations and given speeches engendered than with Jim Fulton. We literally rocked with laughter on many occasions, and it served as a very happy time in the House of Representatives for me. One could hear, for example, John Rich, the congressman from Pennsylvania, a Republican, who had only one speech, and that consisted of the following, quote, "Where are you going to get the money?" End of quote, said John Rich, on every occasion that was even remotely suitable. And then there was Jim Gavin, also of Pennsylvania, who talked with a voice like a torrent of anthracite coal coming down the chute. Jim was an
ex-coal miner. Jim was a bitter opponent of all forms of foreign aid and a complete isolationist. And one day happened on a forensic stratagem, which was terribly amusing. He took to the microphone in the well of the house to speak on a foreign aid bill. And instead of speaking in his usual gravel voice, he spoke in a whisper, and he whispered into the microphone, "My colleagues of the House, I want you to know that today I'm going to speak like a statesman." And this really brought the House down. And then there was Helen Gahagan Douglas, gracious, beautiful, actress by profession, very intelligent, with an enormously warm heart, and deep sympathy for humankind and devotion to peace and international cooperation. When Helen began to speak on any one of these subjects, she was absolutely divine. But then at a given point, which seemed almost inevitable, a voice would attain a lower register. She'd begin to speak from her diaphragm, and then the emotion would come pouring out. And at that point, all too regrettably, she was far less convincing.